Good morning, this is Rob Raccoon.
Oh, hi, this is Juliana Henderson.
Good. And we're here to review the second quarter performance and the markets up through the middle of August for our clients and interested parties. We're going to make this a slightly abbreviated version of the regular clientees that we have in Santa Fe, but we thought that some people might enjoy calling in later to hear our views, a strategy, prognosis, and other sorts of opinions. Generally, the format is a roundtable discussion, but I think today we'll start with just a general overview, and then hopefully there'll be a few additional questions to stimulate the conversation. Overall, the markets have been very strong, as most people realize. Surprisingly, the bond markets have had quite extraordinary returns, just like stocks. Primarily because the government has flooded the market with so much money, and there are so few new bonds being issued that the bonds currently out in the marketplace have been bid up in price, and so both tax-free and taxable bonds have done quite well so far in 2009. It's a very difficult investment environment because of the lack of new bonds being issued. There are some notable exceptions that I'll come back to. Even though there's quite a bit of talk about the recession being over or the end in sight or things getting considerably better, the Federal Reserve and the other central banks are likely to keep rates low for an extended period of time because I think fundamentally they do realize that the economies, certainly of the developed world, of Western Europe and the U.S., are on quite tenuous grounds, and that any rise in interest rates would be very costly in terms of their effect on the economy and on consumer confidence. That being said, there was some interesting news this morning about consumers in France and Germany rushing out to go shopping just like the old days, and people in my office tend to do the same thing, so they're leading indicators too. Right, Juliana?
I didn't say a word.
No, but we have a constant stream of boxes coming in our office for Juliana, et cetera.
It's many to help which, UPS know where we've moved to.
Yes. So, but in France and Germany, people are back in the store shopping. That's certainly not the case here. The U.S. savings rate has gone up for the first time in 20 years from a negative rate where more debt was being taken on by most consumers to where there's about a 5% savings rate. It's interesting that economists feel that every increase, every 1% rise in the savings rate has a corresponding 1% decline in the gross national product of sales and manufacturing, most experts feel that the U.S. savings rate will continue to climb for the next decade at about 1% a year, which means that instead of a normal growth rate of 3 to 4%, just due to the increase in savings, because so much in value of people's 401k and real estate, their home value has declined, that that will put a kind of a limit on the amount of growth that we experience here in this country, and that's not even talking about sort of international trade or the cost of commodities and other the financial world's impact. Just pure consumer savings will reduce our long-term growth rate for the next, certainly 3 to 5 years. Some people say 10 years. So I guess we have to be careful what we wish for when we were bemoaning the lack of savings on the part of the U.S. Public. Let's see, the international markets in stocks have rebounded kind of in pace with our large cap market. The technology market is notable in that we've seen very, very large run-ups in some very popular companies, Apple, Google, IBM, Cisco, the networking company. These are companies who, in the depths of a recession, had ample financing, were gaining market share, and the market has bid them up a great deal over the last 6 months, so much so that our strategy at the moment is to be taking profits off the table, certainly selling a lot of half positions in the technology area. And it's difficult to postulate that the kind of growth that's already priced into the stock market will actually occur, because the market is counting on a full recovery at this point, what they call a V-shaped recovery, where it goes straight down and then straight back up again. We don't think that is the shape of the recovery, more like a Roman L, which is down and then very, very slow, gradual. It almost looks directly horizontal with no growth. But we think there'll be some growth going forward, certainly in the short term due to the government stimulus programs. That money, about 20% of it has reached the real economy so far. There's still 80% of that first stimulus program which has still not been spent. That will help generate some growth, and commodity prices and economic activity in Asia will help global growth as well. But again, I guess the overall theme is that when you read about the stock market going up 40% in the last 3 months, it's only up 10% year to date from the beginning of the year, but from its depths, some stocks are up 40%. What you're seeing is sort of the euphoria that we're not having a global meltdown, that some areas of the world, I talked a little bit about Germany and France, but China certainly is reported to have robust growth. We're very suspect of the Chinese numbers. The Chinese tend to report what they think their superiors want to hear, and when the central government says to grow, then everyone, all the banks go out and lend money, because in effect, they're indirectly owned and managed by the central government. The banks lend money to industries which produce what the government tells them to produce. For example, let's say wind turbines, because they have a public announcement that a certain portion of their energy will be, addressed by wind energy. But the output of Chinese factories can be of very poor quality. It can sit on their shelves or not even get out the door, and they will book it as a sale so that it contributes to the Chinese gross national product and shows up as growth. That's not necessarily the case. There's some sense that Chinese manufacturing, that there's a tremendous amount of waste and, of course, shoddy products, which, you know, you see when you read about the humanitarian crises, when the, you know, the schools fall down or the bridges or the dams collapse. We can hope that the nuclear power plants they're building at a pretty fast clip don't have the same sort of quality control issues. Eastern Europe, things are awful. Latvia is essentially bankrupt. A number of the Central European nations have had to turn to the International Monetary Fund. They got caught up in the sort of the whole real estate bubble. Southern Europe, boy, could you put that on mute, Juliana?
Yeah, sorry.
That'd be great. The economic activity in Central Europe has fallen off dramatically. They are certainly in a depression. And the banks in Southern Europe, Italy, Spain, Portugal, did a lot of lending to Central Europe because they felt like it was easy money. And, of course, those economies now are suffering because Central Europe can't repay the loans. And so there's quite a disparity between Germany and France that are reporting some growth and the Eurozone countries that have unemployment around 15%, such as Spain and Portugal and Italy. Hard to figure out what's going to happen there. They don't have the, I guess I would say, the benefit of a strong central bank. The countries are not, their monetary and fiscal policies are constrained by agreement, but those are conveniently ignored often, such as the oil quota outputs are ignored by the OPEC countries. They try and present a united front, but really there's a lot of fudging and whatever normal business activity there behind the scenes in the Eurozone. So the U.S. dollar has held up reasonably well. In the news during the quarter, we've seen China talk a lot, Brazil chiming in, even India joining, saying that the world needs a new kind of currency, a new trading unit of value, implying that the U.S. dollar, that it's the days of its hegemony as the preeminent currency, as the reservoir of value that all countries believe in, is waning, and that really is a very important issue. Our deficits are financed. Our standard of living is supported by the U.S. dollar being the reserve currency, and any movement away from that, while it may be good for some U.S. companies that do a lot of business overseas, it certainly would be terrible for the long-term financial stability of the country, and certainly for the consumer prices. And my opinion is that's probably inevitable, that the U.S. dollar lose its position as the only currency that international trade has done. China and Brazil, China and many countries in Latin America are already doing business based in the Chinese currency or a combination of currencies. So that's probably one of the most important developments, you know, that are long-term. and it's something that we look to our portfolios and think about how can we diversify both internationally and in, you know, in the U.S. into companies that, that have an ability to cope with that changing situation about the world's currencies. One way of doing that is in natural resources. We, during the second quarter, had some large positions in energy and energy pipelines, also in real estate, having been sort of beaten up and assumed to be dead on arrival, has proved itself not to be dead on arrival. And I'm not talking about, you know, individual homes or buildings, but things that are called real estate investment trusts. So those have been some of the best performing investments. They're a little, well, there's still some that are of value. We tend to focus on apartment buildings and multifamily, you know, houses, as opposed to commercial property in the real estate that we look for. In the energy area, we tend to focus on natural gas. It is likely that coal and nuclear power will both see a tremendous increase in use in North America. That doesn't necessarily bode well for the carbon emissions levels or things like that, but from an economic standpoint, coal and nuclear energy probably are the easiest things. They're the easiest solutions, no matter how much we hear about renewable energy and how much we're personally in favor of it. It's important to look at sort of where the reserves of energy are, what the cost is of bringing them to the market, and so we try and keep our eyes on those things as well. Let's see. I've kind of rambled on for quite a while here, and so maybe I'll see whether there are areas that anyone thinks that I might address. So any questions or topics that anyone would like to see discussed?
Today in the news, BB&T is buying the assets of Colonial Bank, which was seized by the FDIC. What are your thoughts on what's happening with the banks? Are we going to see more failures, or are they working their way out?
Well, you know, BB&T is a bank that we own a fair amount of. Colonial Bank, based in Montgomery, I believe Alabama has sort of the track record for being the worst place in the nation for bonds and for banks. Birmingham, Alabama was where the big municipal bond issue for the sewer project recently went into reorganization, a $3 billion sewer expansion. That's, well, I won't make any puns quite like that, since I don't want to offend anyone, but that's a lot of stuff to
reported line.
A lot of stuff to float around. There are a lot of banks in trouble, and there are likely to be many, many more bank failures, mergers. They're not really attracting that much attention in the media, which is kind of interesting. These banks that recently have gone under, the Colonial is one, is primarily due to residential real estate, consumer lending, and just basically bad management. There's a plethora of banks, and we'll talk about the big banks in a minute because they really are in a different class, but there are many, many banks who have commercial real estate on their books, commercial loans that are coming up for renewal, And with the increasingly stringent lending standards and the requirement that new appraisals be obtained, and most appraisals will be down 20 to 30% from where they were when these original loans were made, you'll find that the banks are just not willing to lend for fear of being criticized by their regulators, then you'll find that the borrowers are not able to repay, and the borrowers have already started in the commercial real estate markets to turn back projects, very large projects, to the banks, and so the government's efforts to deal with the first wave of financial problems, the sort of interbank lending, all of the things that were in the news last fall with Bear Stearns and Shearson, where they swapping these exotic instruments and nobody, you know, really having faith in the system at all, that basically has been taken care of. And there's a lot of liquidity in the interbank system now. The hope was the next big problem was the residential mortgages of people who borrowed too much, who had adjustable rate mortgages, who, you know, the values of the homes were wrong then, even then, much less now with the real estate market having contracted so much. And I was reading some numbers about the number of mortgages that have been reworked to date, and Bank of America is the worst at about 5% of their delinquent borrowers have been addressed by Bank of America. Some of the smaller banks are better, but really probably less, around 1 in 5 of people who are in trouble have been able to get help so far. And as a result, even if that number gets better as these programs get clearer and people get used to the long lines, et cetera, is that there's still a tremendous overhang of inventory in the housing market in most places, certainly where values have gone down 50%. There are buyers for bankruptcies, for foreclosures and things like that. And so there is a bottom to the housing market. It just hasn't been reached yet. And the time frame, and this, of course, affects the banks on the residential real estate, the time frame for the market firming up is probably 2 years. And so the banks have not been willing to renegotiate the loans and realize the losses that they actually have. That's the residential real estate sector of the market. The commercial real estate part of the market is much worse. The loans are much bigger. I think everyone in the country knows that, you know, by just anecdotal evidence that retail shops are going out of business, that malls are losing key anchor stores, and that there's just a heck of a lot of property for sale or rent. And so prices are soft, and the government is trying to figure out really how to deal with this whole commercial aspect. They've you know, essentially allowed the banks to restate and ignore the accounting rules that came in last year that made the banks actually fess up to their problems. And in a couple of different ways, the government has backed away from that, and that's one of the reasons the banks during the second quarter of and so far in the third quarter of 2009 have done so well, is that they basically have said, the government said, here's free money, essentially no charge, and let's not worry right now about how many bad loans you have, because when we tell the public that we're going to do a stress test, it's really going to be a pretty easy thing. It's mostly for public relations purposes. And so we really don't know how bad the bank situation is. It's very bad. I read a lot about it. I don't know who to believe, really, but I know that the bad news is not all out, and that I wouldn't be a buyer of a bank stock for anything, unless one was a sort of a day trader, which we're not. So that remains really an Achilles' heel of the economic environment. We talked about retail. So I don't know. That's, you know, it's a lot of that is sort of gloomy and pessimistic. It's in contrast to the behavior of the market by and large, and people are feeling very optimistic that unemployment numbers are, you know, improving, which again is another way that the media spins the economic news. Unemployment numbers in July were less than June, but still as high or a little higher than they have been in every other deep recession, you know, since the 30s. The monthly unemployment claims are extremely high. They were improved, which is nice. Some people say they were improved only because a lot of people have stopped looking for work and are no longer counted. That the census, I guess there's a census coming up in 2010, which is not that far away. The government has started hiring census workers, and you know, 100,000 temporary jobs with the government are counted in the employment numbers. The auto industry, with this revived demand generated by the Cash for Clunkers program, that those jobs are being counted, and who knows whether that demand for, you know, cars will continue after this Clunkers program peters out. Maybe it will, but I wouldn't count on it. And so the areas of the markets that look the best to us are international, are U.S. companies that do business internationally, that are tied to commodities that are stable in price, that have not been bid up. You know, copper and a lot of the industrial commodities have been bid up because everyone just perceives China and Asia as having an insatiable appetite for certain industrial commodities. So we tend to stay away from those and stick with things like natural gas. See, did that adequately address the banking issue?
I think so.
Okay. Juliana, anything come to mind? You're so quiet now that you've put it on mute.
I'm back now.
All right.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the fixed income portion of the market and what people should be thinking about to keep their purchasing power up and their cash flow okay if we're in a long period of low interest rates.
Okay, good question. The fixed, you know, the bond market, fixed income, same thing. As I said earlier, there are very few new bonds coming to the market. I think around half of the level as last year. It's a mystery to me why that's the case, because the rates are so low, and you would think people would want to, municipalities and companies would want to issue debt, but at these low interest rates. But for some reason, the markets just are not open to them, I guess the banks aren't buying bonds. They're just keeping their cash in cash because they don't want to take any risk at all. And so individual investors, you know, are faced with this conundrum of basically zero interest rates on savings accounts and CDs or U.S. treasuries, or near zero rates of return. And there are some people who are so afraid of future inflation, figuring that because there's so much monetary and fiscal stimulus, so much money being printed and so many government programs, you know, a couple billion here and a couple of billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about serious money. I wonder when we'll have that conversation about trillions of dollars, and we'll be like the Brazilians and, you know, carting around wheelbarrows. That's the fear that some people have of inflation, and we can talk a little bit about that, inflation versus deflation. But people who are convinced that inflation is coming back are buying these inflation adjustable bonds that essentially pay no interest at all. It's like buying insurance. There's actually a net cost to some bondholders, and that's, you know, it's not like they're unsophisticated, because that's essentially what the government of China is wanting from the U.S. now, rather than a set rate of interest. They want a fluctuating rate of interest on their new bonds, and everyone knows that China is one of the major, you know, buyers of our country's debt that we issue to finance the deficit. And of course the deficit is astronomically high now, and likely to go higher if the economy doesn't reignite. So the Chinese are wanting these inflation adjusted bonds. They're willing to take essentially no return currently in order to have that future protection. There are very few individuals who are like that. There are some, but it's not a position that we take. We believe that there are bonds in a certain maturity range, let's say, that mature from three to five years out, or 3 to 6 years out, that are paying between 3, 4, and 5%, and that they're good quality bonds. They're not totally without risk, but we think the risk is worth taking. And especially there's a new class of bonds called taxable municipal bonds. Normally bonds issued by municipalities or states are tax-free. These are taxable bonds. They compete with CDs and corporate bonds. And the government, the federal government, is subsidizing the interest on these bonds because of part of the Rebuild America program. And so the government, I think, ponies up a third of the interest expense. And so we've been buying a great deal of bonds in that 3 to 6 year range. There's very little to do on the short end. You know, if you want a lot of liquidity or you need your money in a month or 2 months, there's something that we've been doing a lot of, which is, and you know, in the investment business, you always end up eating your words that you pronounced, you know, in a different environment. So we've been buying these short-term bond funds, which pay 2%, 2 to 3%, and they're very stable. But when the market decides they've had enough of Uncle Sam, you know, and his credit card binge, or whatever programs, you know, are in place, those short-term bond funds, you know, will go down, and it's incumbent upon us to get out before that happens. So we're kind of like have our finger on the trigger, sort of nervously looking for signs that that the government is going, or the markets are going to raise rates up. The one pronouncement that came out earlier this week was that the Fed, which has been using, you know, every everything in the kitchen sink and everything outside to throw at the economy. One of the devices they've used is they've been buying, they issue their own debt and then they buy it themselves. It'd be funny if it wasn't sort of long-term dysfunctional. And so the Fed has announced that in October they're going to stop doing that in increments. They're going to stop buying the federal government's debt. So that's something that people say, oh, wow, well, everything must really be getting better because the economy has to have a stable bottom, has to have reached this point of inflection for the Fed to take that action. I don't, you know, they've got to do it sometime. It's, a lot of people think it's absurd they did it in the first place. And whether the market waits for then for the interest rates to start to move up or before, or whether nothing happens, you know, no one knows. So those short-term bond funds are not without risk. They have to be managed pretty actively. There are bonds in the tax-free area that we like. They're not without risk. I think one thing that's fairly clear that over the next couple of years, income tax rates will be going up on individuals, and that tax-free bonds will have a higher value as that happens. And there are short time periods when certain municipalities or states such as California are required to pay more than they would otherwise because of their budget crisis or whatever. And part of our job is to evaluate the creditworthiness of these bond issuers and to go in and buy things when the general public and the media are down on these issuers because that's when they have the best value, and that's another way that fixed income investors, people who are living off their portfolios, you know, can serve to protect themselves. So hopefully that answers that question.
It did. Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Maybe we'll have time for one more general topic and then wrap it up. Any kind of burning interest to current events or questions about government programs or anything that you see in the media that come to mind? Anyone?
Well, I was wondering, with all the news about the healthcare overhaul, the big drug companies, do you think that they represent a good investment at this time, or would you be rethinking positions in drug companies?
Good question. Healthcare reform is certainly in the news. I think everyone who uses health or dental care or has something, you know, has an opinion about it, and certainly it's something that President Obama has staked a good deal of political capital on. And I just saw a research piece on the deal that Obama cut with the drug companies, saying that any health plan would not involve the government using its purchasing power to negotiate lower prices on pharmaceutical companies. So that's, I guess, a little disappointing for people who are idealistic about our president or about what might be attainable this round of discussions on healthcare reform. Pharmaceutical companies, just to answer your question directly, have been a very poor investment for a very long time, with some notable exceptions for short periods. But the heyday of drug company profitability and their ability to price new products and to sell new products certainly has gone away over the last 5 years, probably even longer. So by and large, we're not big buyers of pharmaceutical companies. Some of them pay a very healthy dividend, and they're very high quality. Johnson & Johnson, Abbott are two of them. But as a class of investments, I would say pharmaceutical companies, while they may have escaped this round of negotiations, in the long run, their profitability is certainly going to be reduced. Not that there isn't a need for their products, that they have very bright people working, and that there needs to be an incentive, and that there will be some incentive for them. But you know, where you reach a point where they've really made some advances, and the public needs those drugs, and they can't afford them, and certainly most people can't afford drugs. And that not only overseas, but even in the U.S., there's large segments of the population that if they had to pay for their drugs, they couldn't. And so that kind of raises the other sort of smoking gun in the healthcare discussion, which are the insurance companies. And that's another investment opportunity that we don't believe in, not just because I personally can't stand the insurance companies and never have. But that, you know, they're basically, you know, and they do make money sometimes. They certainly are the most sophisticated and knowledgeable about the politics surrounding healthcare. And there are, I believe, six lobbyists for every one lawmaker in Washington just on the healthcare issue. I can't remember, someone told me that senators and congressmen are not above changing their positions on these matters depending on their, you know, support level from insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. So I think we're a very long way from any real fundamental change in healthcare, likely going to take some kind of a crisis. I don't know what that might look like, whether it's a bird flu or some kind of a virus or who knows what, you know, what it is. But there's no question that the financial system, which the financial industry, which drove the economy for the last 10 years and pretty much drove it into a wall, that there are some fundamental reforms coming, but that the same people will essentially stay in control, and the kind of unfair advantage that's given to institutions and people within the financial industry are likely to stay in place, even though they're part of the problem that caused these structural excesses. Government regulation is likely going to increase in the financial area. I don't know about the drug area or the insurance area. To me, it seems like, you know, the insurance people run Washington, that Washington does not run the insurance. And that probably could be said of Washington and Goldman Sachs as well, but I know I keep flipping back to the financial area from pharmaceuticals and industries, but I think there are a lot of analogies between the industries and the fact that politics plays such a huge role in the financial opportunities in those industries. Insurance is built on tax breaks. And the insurance companies, you know, essentially took on the whole role as government has in other countries, as being the mediator, arbitrator, definer of what healthcare means, who pays for it, who gets rich from it. I don't know, you know, I don't really know much about the solutions to it, whether a single payer system is really a solution. There's certainly a lot of opposition to it. among people who make money now, insurance companies, doctors, drug companies, you know, people who don't want the government involved in anything to do with their personal lives. That's always a big factor. Whether insurance companies are a suitable surrogate for government involvement, I don't believe that. But they certainly have the upper hand, and I guess that would represent some kind of an investment opportunity for some people. But you know, I just think that it's unethical, and that its time is limited. So it's not an area that I'm interested in. In buying either the stocks or bonds in. So, you know, Obama is very, very smart, and I don't begrudge him for giving in to pressures from different industrial groups. He can only do so much at the current time, you know, we'll see. Most of the real action happens where we can't see it on healthcare reform. So, you know, with that, I think I'll just kind of wrap it up with a couple of minutes discussion of what we're likely to see going forward, and then kind of an invitation for anyone who listens, if you have questions, to give us a call here at the office. The most likely scenario going forward is that the government continues to print money and bail out any financial institution that looks like it's important to the system, to maintaining consumer confidence. I think it's very unlikely that the traditional drivers of economic growth in the U.S. return anywhere near the level that they were 2 or 3 years ago, because of the great loss of wealth and the need for people to save, and actually the one topic I didn't touch much on was inflation versus deflation. So let me just do that, because the assumption that we're going to have 70s style inflation, I think is incorrect. Everyone remembers when Reagan came in and Volcker raised interest rates, and people were expecting, you know, to have 18% returns on CDs for the rest of their life, and everyone was going out to buy because things were getting more expensive every day that you waited. I think those days are gone, certainly for the next 5 years. There's a tremendous amount of global capacity in manufacturing. There's way more qualified people for most jobs than there are job opportunities. That will keep a damper on wage inflation. We may well see a commodity inflation, particularly oil and energy, but at the moment there's an oversupply of those things as well. The impact of the Fed producing an extra trillion or $2 trillion is certainly out there, but it's unlikely to manifest itself in the traditional type of inflation where real estate goes up, stocks and bonds go up, and people are borrowing money and spending money so that they get, you know, goods now, and a lot of bad deals get bailed out because prices go up. I think we're likely to see price deflation for quite some period of time. Interest rates will stay lower than traditionally they have been, just because the economies of the world can't stomach a high barrier of high interest rates. The rates being held low will not necessarily help people on fixed income or retirements who are not sort of actively managing their portfolios. And so you know, we have deflation in earnings and asset values, some inflation in the costs of high-end goods and services. It puts the consumer in a pickle. requires just a great deal more active management. So I think on that note, we'll end this this call, and appreciate your interest. Thanks very much.